her children and her her father, the holy prophets. So, practical lessons for today. Communicate openly. Ask your family members what they can handle and be honest about your own limits. Share duties wisely. Align tasks with strengths. One may be good at finances, another at cooking, another at emotional support. And provide reassurance and support, just as Lady Fatima reassured Imam Ali Salam. Encourage your family, show gratitude, and make them feel valued. And in the society as well. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
And bring in our special guest. His name is Mossab. He is a journalist, and he is going to break down what is happening in Sudan. Let's go ahead and bring him in. What's going on, Mossab?
Hey, Sabrina. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining. This has probably been one of the most requested topics from viewers that watch the show. They do want someone to explain what exactly is happening in Sudan and if the U.S. is involved. So I want to start with this article here. For those who are not aware, this was reported recently that there was blood visible from space in Sudan. It says it shows evidence of the Darfur genocide. Now, I know, Mossab, you don't want to get, you know, too much, you know, into this. But it does point back to the genocide that is happening in Sudan. If you could, please, first and foremost, explain to us, how did all of this begin?
So thank you for having me on, Sabrina. This basically started decades ago. I mean, the Sudan government for a long time, if you go back to the 70s, it was, you know, it was kind of coerced into joining the U.S. policy in the region. So it was used kind of as a weapon against Libya, against Chad, against Ethiopia, all at the time who had pretty much, you know, sovereign governments. They had their own internal problems. But essentially, Sudan was brought into that neoliberal fold. The government kind of did a U-turn in the 90s, and they, you know, claimed sovereignty, and they didn't want to follow the U.S. policy anymore. But they went in a very extreme direction of kind of, you know, supporting militant Islamist groups and, you know, hosting bin Laden and all that kind of stuff. And that got them on the radar for regime change. In the late 90s, you know, the late Dick Cheney and his friends, the neocons, they put Sudan on the list of, you know, seven countries to be toppled in 5 years. You know, so it was on that list along with Iran and Syria and Libya and Iraq. But they kind of compromised with the U.S. and they let South Sudan separate to become its own country. So after that, then, you know, the Arab Spring came along. You know, Bashir got pretty shook by it. and he decided to go fully into the fold of the Gulf Arab countries and kind of under the fold of the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Egypt. The main thing that brings these countries together is that these are the countries that are allies of the U.S., and they're the ones that have a good relationship with Israel. You know, they might not, you know, outright have a lot of diplomatic relationships with Israel and everything, but that changed in 2020 with the Abraham Accords. But the struggle inside of Sudan has always been the problem of a fascist government in Khartoum. In Khartoum, the capital, for the last 40-plus years, there's been a fascist government, far-right extremist, you know, policies. You know, they claim sovereignty, but they work with the World Bank and put heavy austerity measures, privatizing large sectors of the economy. So they've been going along with that program, but kind of walking that step. Until 2014, that's when they joined it fully into that fold of the Gulf Arab countries. Then in 2019, a popular movement sparked and, you know, removed Bashir. Once Bashir was out of the picture, the strong man who was kind of towing that line between the East and the West and everything, then it became kind of an open playing field for a lot of intelligence, you know, U.S. intelligence, Israeli intelligence, the UAE, Turkey, you know, people, because of the strategic location of Sudan and the amount of resources. You know, Sudan geographically is a place that connects North Africa with the Horn of Africa, East Africa, Central Africa, and the Sahel region. You know, if you look at Sudan and its geography, it connects all of these regions together. So historically, it was even like a superhighway of civilizations and of movement and of trade and stuff like that. And that's why it's always been on the U.S.'s radar as far as a place that has to be put, quote unquote, under control. This pressure, like neo-colonial pressure, led to the powers inside of Sudan, specifically the army and the RSF, vying for power. And not just political power, but economic power as well. And this is where countries like the UAE fully adopted the RSF. Now, those of you, your audience who are old enough, probably remember in the 2000s, the Save Darfur movement, you know, the genocide in Darfur. And people usually don't follow up to see, you know, what happened to that campaign, like what happened to that genocide. The genociders won. The Janjaweed militia actually was legitimized and became the RSF that we know today, and the European Union funneled money to them so that they can protect the borders and quell migration. You know, the UAE and Saudi Arabia recruited them so that they fight the Houthis, Ansar Allah, in Yemen. You know, so the RSF slowly became a country within a country. So they committed genocide in the 2000s, and then when Bashir was removed, they overthrew another civilian government, and then became the question of, well, how can you have two armies in one country? You know, you can't have the official army SAF and you can't have the RSF side by side. There has to be a security structure, security sector reform. And that's where basically the old guard that were in SAF and the new guard that's in the RSF bumped heads, because none of them want to give up power. None of them want to give up the resources, the vast gold mines, the livestock, you know, all the political power that comes along with that. You know, the Red Sea, you know, so many different countries want ports on the Red Sea. That's also a part of it. Food security for the Middle East, you know, Sudan has vast agricultural projects. But so all of these things kind of created the perfect storm. But it's still, I mean, you see in 2023 and 2024, Netanyahu brought out to the UN General Assembly a map that had the new Middle East. And it basically included the Gulf countries, Egypt, and Sudan. You know, so, you know, there was some criticisms in the beginning of the war. You know, people were like, you know, don't make everything about Israel. Well, you know, Sudan got pushed into this new Middle East map. And apparently all of the policies that were pushed on it were in lockstep with U.S. and Israel policy. And this just basically broke the country, because they propped up these criminal entities like the RSF and Bashir's party, the NCP, within you know, controlling staff. And, you know, one of the goals of this war is to kill any kind of sovereign citizen movement to move towards democracy and let go of these, you know, monopolies, these military monopolies on the Sudanese economy. There are other issues as well. You know, the Bashir regime for 40 years has been pushing an Islamo-Arab-centric policy and trying to make Sudan into one homogeneous, you know, identity of being Arabs and being Muslim. And this also made non-Arabs within Sudan, indigenous groups, feel like they're second-class citizens. That's what led to the separation of South Sudan. It led to genocides in South Sudan, in Darfur, in the Nuba Mountains. So we have a lot of complex problems that were never solved, and everything was just pushed under the rug, and this is what led right now. But the genocide that's going on right now in El Fashir is kind of a continuation of a long, you know, track record of this central government basically trying to quell its citizens and coerce them.
So once again, Israel is involved. Skylar brings up a good point here. So they want Sudan as part of the new Middle East because Sudan has all the gold and farmland.
That's part of it, yes. But more importantly, so that Sudan doesn't become part of a resistant axis to U.S. and Israel policy. You know, Sudan is a country of 40 million people. You know, it's between it and Israel, there's only one country geographically, and that's Egypt. So the proximity also, the geographic proximity, is makes it so where that they want to make sure Sudan kind of is kept in check. And, of course, part of it is also they don't want Sudan to be a solid ally with Russia or China or any one of the other competing countries with the West. So, yeah, I mean, there's a couple of reasons. The resources is part of it. And part of it is kind of geostrategic as well.
So we cannot stress this enough, that once again, we have another conflict that Israel is a part of. I want to get your opinion about this, Masab. I have seen videos of people fleeing Sudan. When people are fleeing Sudan right now, those who are able to get out, where are they going?
So that's one of the biggest, the big tragedy right now is the magnitude of the war itself. Try to think about this. 12 million people displaced. 12 million people being displaced. Basically, the Sudanese, they went in all different directions. You know, there's 1.5 million that went to Egypt. There's another 1.5 million that went to Chad. 1.2 million went to South Sudan. I know family members people who went to Saudi Arabia. Some people went to Kenya. So really, when you look at the migration map as a result of this war, the Sudanese citizens had to disperse in all directions just to get away from all the carnage.
So Egypt is taking in a lot of people then.
Absolutely.
Because my friend Nico House, he went to Egypt about a year ago, and he said he was surprised to see how many refugees were in Egypt. There were even Syrian refugees in Egypt. He had mentioned that. So it just seems like Egypt is taking in a lot of people. So this is really interesting. Thank you so much for this. The Oracle says, which group represents the indigenous Sudanese people?
I mean, they're all pretty much indigenous. But when we talk about non-indigenous, we don't want to make it seem as if these people are not Sudanese. They're Sudanese, but there are nomadic groups in Sudan. The nomadic groups go cross-border. So they would be in Sudan. They would go out, you know, a lot of them are from Chad, Niger. But the agricultural communities, the indigenous communities like in Darfur and in the Nuba Mountains, in the far north of Sudan and the eastern part of Sudan, there's a lot of indigenous groups. The complication comes in when, you know, the Bashir regime set up this kind of pro-Arabized Sudanese agenda, where the non-Arab indigenous groups are the ones that get the brunt of the war. They suffer the most. Since the days of South Sudan, you have people in Darfur, in the Nuba Mountains, in Blue Nile State, the southern and southern western and southern southeastern parts of Sudan have historically had, you know, the worst experience when it comes to, you know, the state violence and the genocide that's been perpetrated on them.
So how can this particular issue, is there a way to solve this genocide in Sudan? And why aren't more, and this is just a question I've been having for a long time. Why aren't other nations in that region pushing back against what is happening in Sudan?
Okay, so, I mean, there's two folds to this. Like, the solutions right now, there's kind of two tracks that are going. The U.S. is hosting, you know, talks between the Egypt, the Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. And they're talking strictly to the army and the RSF. And you know, there's some, you know, partial breakthrough. You know, they're talking now about what the conditions are for the ceasefire. For like a humanitarian pause and then a ceasefire. So that's going along slowly. The other track is with the African Union bringing together all of the political actors in Sudan to have a comprehensive dialogue. So that was supposed to kick off like a few months ago. It got delayed. But most likely, if there's a breakthrough with this ceasefire, then there would be that bigger dialogue. And that's actually where the fundamental problems should be solved. So the issue of accountability is a huge one, where basically there has to be some framework of transitional justice. You know, just like a lot of African conflicts, you have to have truth and reconciliation. You have to have some sort of accountability for war crimes. You have to have some kind of rapprochement to the millions of IDPs and refugees right now return. You have to have some form of security sector reform where you have one national army instead of all of the armed groups that are in Sudan right now. So these are solutions, but they're slow solutions. But, you know, there's no way around it this time. You know, there were wars, a lot of wars in Sudan that ended in negotiations, but they ended with power sharing rather than ending with some kind of fundamental dialogue to actually see how to move forward from there and how to avoid any of these wars in the future. So these things are in their infancy stages, unfortunately. But the reason the countries around Sudan are not able to stop this is because our neighbors are at war with each other as well, unfortunately. You know, Egypt and Ethiopia have a long-standing conflict, partially to do with the GERD Dam, the Renaissance Dam in Ethiopia, and Egypt just outwardly hostile towards the dam, claiming that it'll affect the Nile waters, but it's more about regional influence and hegemony. You know, you have, you know, Khartoum has historically had a bad relationship with Chad. They, of course, South Sudan separated, so there's some tension over there. A bad relationship with Libya. You know, Eritrea and Ethiopia are not on the same page anymore, you know, and they're kind of weighing how this war would affect them. And it really did. The war did affect all of the neighboring countries, you know, from cross-border, you know, troop movements to, like, you know, encroachment to taking in so many refugees. So all of the countries do actually want this war to stop, but they're not agreeing among each other. You know, these are some of the problems that we have within the African Union of, you know, conflicts within that. But there's been some positive steps. Like, for example, the BRICS included both Egypt and Ethiopia into the BRICS. They added them in 2023, I think, as a way to also say that, hey, you know, we're all part of the same kind of global South, so why don't we stop the fighting and focus on development and partnerships and stuff like that. But again, you know, it didn't really, you know, show any concrete results yet. But the long arc of, you know, this conflict will end with some kind of negotiated settlement. It's just a question of how long will that take.
Okay, here's a great question here from Ancient Crustacean. Where is the foreign intelligence in this war? Is there a local side versus a native side funded by foreigners? Or are both sides funded by foreign nations? Or is it like Gaza and there isn't two sides, it's one side doing all the bad? That's a good question. Where is the funding coming from?
So who's at war right now? The Sudan Armed Forces against the RSF. The Sudan Armed Forces is primarily pushed by Egypt. You know, Egypt has had a, you know, since 2019, unfortunately, has had a pretty negative role in Sudan, you know, trying to solidify military rule in Sudan, but also kind of, you know, adopting SAF as their close ally. The bigger and more, you know, dangerous threat is from the UAE. You know, the UAE have adopted the RSF and have been funding it since way before the war. And through the war in Yemen, they've enabled the RSF to be kind of a country within a country. So unfortunately, you know, there aren't any good actors leading the charge of the war. But the you know, these things change, you know, and, you know, the war, the way it's going right now, I don't see any one of these polar, you know, these leaderships as being someone, you know, people to get behind. Now, that being said, there are a lot of people who picked up arms after 2023 to defend themselves. A lot of people who got into the you know, under the SAF umbrella to defend their areas from the RSF. So these are people that are regular citizens, and they just had to pick up arms. On the other side, the RSF, because they recruit on a tribal basis, if you're part of a tribe that's been targeted by the RSF, then your choices are very clear. Either you join the RSF or you get bulldozed by them. You know, so they're like, all right, yeah.
What is the RSF?
It's the Rapid Support Forces. These are who used to be the Janjaweed in the 2000s. And then during the Bashir regime, they kind of gave them a proper name of the Rapid Support Forces. This is the main militia that's committing the atrocities right now in Darfur.
Okay. Okay. That's good to know, because I think that this is very different, because like when we talk about the genocide that's happening in Gaza, it's a little bit more straightforward, whereas with Sudan, it's a little bit different because there's different groups, as you were referring to there. The Oracle says, so the Sudanese of Arab descent are the groups perpetuating the genocide with the assistance of the UAE and other U.S.-aligned actors?
Yeah, so the whole Arab thing in Sudan is pretty convoluted. You know what I mean? And if you want to look at it that way, both sides have an Arab supremacist undertone to all of their ideology, their movements, their alliances, and everything. So historically, it was both sides that committed the genocide in Darfur. It was both sides that committed the genocides in the Nuba Mountains and in the Blue Nile and these places. So it's actually the same Arab supremacy that got split into two right now. Now, that being said, a lot of non-Arab groups have joined the different sides. Some of them have joined the RSF and some of them have joined SAF. So it's not strictly right now along those ethnic lines. It's more about kind of, you know, geography and alliances right now. But that is a common denominator between SAF and RSF. You know, the policies that they followed and the genocides that were committed by both of them. You know, 2023 is just them kind of disagreeing on who's going to take the bigger piece of the pie when it comes to Sudan.
Wow, this is insane. Why do you feel more corporate media outlets are not discussing this?
I think because of how complicated it is, number one. Number two, there's no clear, you know, good guys and bad guys, you know, the way the media usually likes to put it in a certain box where it's like, okay, who do we root for? You know, and it just doesn't fit that module. But the other part of it, the corporate media doesn't cover it, because both sides, when you follow the money, it goes back to this U.S.-Israel alliance in the region. You know, Sudan's been pushed into this place and been shoved into the Middle East, even though when you look at Sudanese, you can't tell us apart from our African neighbors at all. You know, I could be mistaken for an Ethiopian. A Western Sudan might be mistaken for a Chadian. You know, people in the Nuba Mountains might be mistaken for South Sudanese. Even people in the north are Nubians, and they belong to indigenous black groups. So it's like the insistence of including Sudan into this Western Asia, so-called Middle East fold, is kind of also one of the things that broke the country, and, you know, led to kind of what we're seeing right now.
This is really interesting. Again, I just feel like still a lot of people don't know about this because, you know, it's been happening in the Congo as well. Margaret Kimberly came onto the show to discuss this a while back about genocide in the Congo. Israel had its hand in that as well with the mining, which I discussed before on the show. But I just think that, again, it's just either highly suppressed, but when it comes to corporate media, they're not really discussing this the way that they should. It's alarming.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with organizers of the International Conference in commemoration of Ayatollah Mirza Muhammad Hussein Naini, Rahmatullah Alayh. The meeting took place on October 22nd, 2025. He had a political intellect. He believed in the establishment of an Islamic government. The formation of an Islamic government in itself is a thought. Of course, he didn't specify the form of the government, but he explicitly stated in his remarks in Tanbihul Ummah that an Islamic government must be established. He identifies the core point of such an Islamic government as being the principle of wilayah, or divinely ordained leadership of the Muslims. He refers to it as the hukumat wilayah, a government-based wilayah, in contrast to malikiyah, istibdadiyah, or usurped despotic governance. I believe he uses such a phrase to contrast the government of wilayah, the Islamic wilayah government, with despotic governance. This means that the model, substance, and spirit of governance is wilaya, which is a very important matter in itself and one that deserves much discussion. He explicitly stated this. A few days ago, I heard something from some gentleman who quoted some noble individuals about Mr. Naini's extraordinary night prayer and tahajjud. The late Aga Najafi was his son-in-law who lived in Hamadan. He was a part of the family and had witnessed this personality. He described Mirza Naini's night prayer, the state he was in during them, his humility, his supplications, and his deep spiritual state. These things existed, and of course, it is these very things that help one find the right path, move along that path, and achieve results. We hope that, God willing, this very interesting gathering of yours, whether it's held in Qum, Najaf, or Mashhad, will be successful. It's good that you've also organized efforts in Mashhad. The late Mr. Milani, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hadi Milani, truly revived Mr. Naini's name in Mashhad. This is because what was most prevalent in Mashhad, due to the presence of the late Agazadeh, the son of the late Ahund Khorasani, was the thoughts of Ahund.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding.
us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UN Security Council's recent authorization of an international stabilization force, the ISF, in Gaza has sparked sharp contention. Supporters frame it as a transitional mission to secure a ceasefire, enable humanitarian relief, and prepare for reconstruction. Critics, though, including Palestinian resistance movements, denounce it as an infringement on self-determination, while the European Union warns against altering Gaza's demographic and territorial integrity and insist on a two-state solution. The spotlight now turns on whether the ISF represents genuine stabilization or a new form of external control. I am Bahman Roy. Let us begin with the report.
The UN Security Council has voted in favor of a U.S. plan for Gaza, including supporting the establishment and deployment of an international stabilization force. Under the adopted resolution, foreign troops will operate under a unified command to secure the territory, oversee its demilitarization, and facilitate aid delivery through safe corridors. The measure passed overwhelmingly. However, major powers, Russia and China, abstained, arguing that the resolution fails to outline a clear role for the UN in Gaza's future and lacks enough detail on how it will be implemented.
In essence, the Council is giving its blessing to a U.S. initiative on the basis of Washington's promises, giving complete control over the Gaza Strip to the Board of Peace and the International Stabilization Force, the modalities of which we know nothing about so far.
The draft resolution is vague and unclear on many critical elements. It should have explained in detail their structure, composition, terms of reference, and criteria of preparation, among others. This should have been an essential basis for the Council's serious discussions. However, the draft resolution contains skimpy details on these critical elements.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has also slammed the resolution, saying in a statement that it does not meet the political and humanitarian demands and rights of the Palestinian people. The group insisted that any international force must operate fully under UN supervision and only in coordination with official Palestinian institutions. Other resistance groups have expressed similar concerns, saying the resolution undermines Palestinians' right to self-determination and that it authorizes the U.S. to establish itself as an occupying power. The concerns are in line with repeated alarms that any initiative for the future of Gaza by the U.S. cannot be trusted by Palestinians. That's because Washington is widely known as an accomplice in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Betul Sobeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. And Ajam Mubaraka, founder of the Black Alliance for Peace, joining us from New York in the U.S. Welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you. I'm going to start the conversation with Betul here. Betul, how do Palestinian resistance movements interpret the ISF resolution as undermining their right to self-determination?
Let's talk about, you know, the demands of this, you know, so-called peace plan and this, you know, resolution. In terms of where Palestinian power lies, it talks about the reformation within the U.S. within the PA. It talks about, you know, the reconstruction process of allowing aid in. The ISF is supposedly to train Palestinians to disarm the resistance, to destroy the tunnels. These powers will be introduced to the Palestinian side that they decide should take over when all is ready. And we've seen a lot of back and forth to make this palatable and acceptable. The crux of all of this is that America is the one that wants to arrange the structures in the way that they see fit. Now, what does America not want? They don't want any Palestinian formation that is independent. If we just put the resistance on the side for a moment, even the PLO, you know, the Palestinian Liberation Organization that was formed by Yasser Arafat, which we had the PA that came out of Oslo, even that in its current form is rejected by America and the Israeli occupation entity, despite the fact that Israel itself was the signatory to the Oslo Accords. And we saw that Palestine fulfilled its side, but the Israeli occupation entity didn't fulfill their side. So the PA is rejected. You know, Israel reached a point of annexing the West Bank despite, you know, the Oslo Accords splitting it up into areas A, B, C, etc. And that goes to the heart of the matter, and that is because the PA was not their creation, despite the fact that the PA takes orders from the Israeli occupation entity and follows them. But ultimately, they want to form the authority in control. Of course, in all of this, the resistance is also rejected, which is inherently a part and parcel of the people. And the people have made their decision. We've seen it clear in the past 2 years from the people of Gaza that they stand with the resistance as well.
Right, I want to continue another conversation, bringing Ajamu to the conversation. Really, how can an externally mandated stabilization force, a so-called ISF, ever be legitimate without the consent of the people it is going to rule on?
It can't be. This is what makes this whole proposal so unserious, that this is a idea that is bound to fail because it continues to sideline the representatives of the Palestinian people themselves. I think this will be a dark date in the history of the United Nations when it becomes clear, I think it's already clear, that the United Nations has basically allowed itself to be bullied by the United States of America into, in essence, surrendering its legitimacy and its power to the United States of America. This idea that the U.S. should have the authority to, along with the Israeli fascists that created the genocide and continued the occupation, the idea that they should be allowed to govern a Palestinian people who are involved in a legitimate struggle of decolonization, a struggle that has as its objective self-determination, it puts the United Nations on the side of the colonizer. This is a absolute departure from the values and the principles of the United Nations and its charter. So this is absolutely outrageous and should be rejected by most of the nations on this planet.
Right, and Batul, considering the different dimensions of this new resolution, which has gone past, you know, the UN Security Council, how much do you think it risks becoming a new form of trusteeship or colonial administration, you know, under international cover?
Ultimately, this goes to the crux of what we're seeing in the region. The whole region is colonized and not stabilized. This needs to be made clear. When we look at Gaza today, more than half of it is already occupied by Israel. So it's not a matter of the ISF risking becoming a colonial administration. The whole of Gaza is besieged today. If you look at even its neighbors, you look at Lebanon, you look at Syria, they're routinely bombed. You look at the Persian Gulf countries, you look at Egypt, you look at Saudi Arabia, they operate under a form of American colonialism in that they are under American dictates. Today, the whole region, this phase of U.S. colonization in the region is at its worst phase because America today is fully calling the shots in terms of how to deal, what is considered acceptable, what isn't. It seeks to get the world's countries to bow with different kinds of excuses. And if we look even beyond continents, from Venezuela to Cuba, using the excuse of the war on drugs, in Lebanon today we see the American paper openly being called as such, and that it needs to be enacted under threats or else Lebanon will be invaded. Today, America is the one giving the dictates and outlining its visions and what it wants to be fulfilled. And we see those dictates, for example, I gave the example of Lebanon, being given to the Lebanese army that is funded by the U.S. You know, we see it canceling its scheduled meetings with the Lebanese army commander because, you know, Lebanon's statement is clearly blaming Israel for its tensions rather than the resistance.
Right.
But today, what we see is the political and military hegemony is from the US. The structures are theirs, the leadership is theirs, as they want it in Gaza, and they decide who fulfills what. So today in Gaza, they want to give the reconstruction to the Persian Gulf countries, the money from them. You have troops in the ISF, they're talking about troops from Islamic countries supposedly being integrated. They want to almost create a contradiction here between even Muslim governments and the people. So we see the decisions of the Security Council ultimately within this framework, which are all inherently colonial.
Right. Achamo, the UN, of course, it's called United Nations. It is supposed to be independent. How do you think it can reconcile stabilization with the principle of self-determination so enshrined in its own charter?
It's impossible. And that's really the point, that basically this is a significant departure from the United Nations charter. This is historic in its implications. And so, as the guest just indicated, this is a reflection of the new power dynamics that basically over the last 2 years, what we have seen unfold in West Asia has been a program of domination, a program that had at the center of its objective the reestablishment of U.S. hegemony in the region, operating through its proxy, Fort Israel. And we the vote the other day in the United Nations was just a culmination of this process. So these principles cannot be reconciled, and that's why they are bound to fail. What is going to be the role of this international stabilization force if the resistance continues, and it will continue? Will they be given a mandate to go in shooting and murdering Palestinian people? This is something that it is unworkable. And again, it's something that we should reject. The only legitimate force that can be inserted is a force under the command of the United Nations with the full cooperation and permission given by the representatives of the Palestinian people themselves. Anything short of that is colonialization.
Right, and Batul, how will this ISF going to engage with de facto local authorities without legitimizing armed control or excluding constituencies?
Right. So within the UN resolution, I mean, there's several things, right? You have that Board of Peace, and then you have the ISF that's overseen by it. And the idea is that it would coordinate with Egypt and the Israeli occupation forces. And their job ultimately would be to train the Palestinians that they want and that they bring to then control the strip. So they are a police state, you know, made up of countries, and one of its jobs is to hit the existing infrastructure that they seek to get rid of. And you also have a Palestinian executive committee, this is outlined within the resolution, that manages the day-to-day governance within the Gaza Strip. So basically technocrats taking care of the civil administration of the state, again, in coordination between Egypt and the Israeli occupation entity. And within that, you have supporting nations like Qatar, Turkey, Egypt, and the US. One important point that I want to raise over here, when we talk about, you know, like the second phase, is, you know, even this 52% of Gaza that is occupied now by Israel, it is clear from this resolution that Israel will not withdraw and will not leave until there is this alternative force ready to govern within the American structure, American created. And all of this means that the second phase, including the withdrawal of the IOF, is hanging and is not bound by time, but by procedures that are very difficult to actualize, because its actualization includes removal of the Gazan resistance. And what does disarmament even mean? You know, what does it mean to destroy the tunnels? What could not be achieved during those 2 years of exercising the maximum degree of force it can apply on Gaza in terms of achieving its objectives? Israel will not be able to achieve during a time of peace. So it will not eliminate the resistance, no part of it, nor its supportive environment. And the mere existence and continuation of the idea and of those who carry the idea of resistance and who remain steadfast on this land means that even the political negotiations cannot replace the military force in extracting what is sought to be extracted. And in the ongoing and existing crisis in Palestine, that is, we're seeing a transformation occurring within the active internal situation that is rejecting this reality. For example, never at any point in time was the resistance able to recruit the number of fighters that it's able to recruit now.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Come from, do you think?
Well, I mean, it comes from their insistence on this fiction of a two-state solution. And I say fiction because the Israeli authorities are clear that they oppose any Palestinian state anywhere in the region. So where is the basis of peace and where is the basis of a so-called two-state solution? So this is a continuation of Oslo, a continuation of the fiction that the European nations are committed to Palestinian rights and a Palestinian state. But the historic experience suggests to us that we can't really take them seriously, that basically they are in alignment with the interests of the U.S. They will articulate some concerns because of their attempts to try to continue to pretend to be the defenders of international law and human rights. But Gaza has exposed the true nature, not only of the Israeli occupation and the Israeli colonial project, but it stripped away any veneer that the West had any kind of commitment to anything called human rights and international law.
Right, Ajam, I want to continue this with you. You mentioned the two-state solution, which is like what the European Union wants and insists on. How do you think this two-state solution goes along with the transitional governance form and model that has been designated for this ISF?
It's impossible to, they can't reconcile these two ideals because basically if you are not prepared to allow the Palestinians to exercise authentic self-determination, then there's no solution. There's no peace process. That's why it's a misnomer to even refer to this as a peace process. This is a demand for the surrendering of the Palestinian resistance. This is a demand that any aspirations for Palestinian self-determination be abandoned. What is unique about this process is that we have a situation developing where you have sort of a new creation of a whole colonial administration that the Israelis have been almost forced to give up some degree of control over Gaza to the interest of the United States of America.
Right. And Batul, I want to focus on Russia and China's role. And they abstained rather than like voting negative to this resolution. I want to talk. I want you to tell me, what do you think? How does this reflect wider concerns regarding the implementation and implications of this resolution on the future of Palestine?
Right. I mean, Russia and China abstaining. I mean, ultimately, that means they, at the heart of it, were against this resolution. This resolution, but they don't have alternatives. And they also have reservations. Ultimately, this proves to me even more the point that, practically speaking, this plan of America will not work. And ultimately, that's because the Palestinians have proven that they will not accept to be besieged and occupied, and that's what October the 7th was a result of. But at the same time, no one should expect the liberation in Palestine to come from anywhere other than the Palestinians themselves. I mean, in two years of a genocide, we've not seen China reduce its trade relations with the Israeli occupation entity, which is its largest trade partner. I mean, in 2024 alone, like, the total goods trade between the entity and China was up to 16 billion, and it was up around 10% from 2023. And its imports actually rose in 2024. And likewise with Russia. I mean, Russia has its interests with the occupation entity too. You have its, you know, Zionist Jewish oligarchs within Russia. You've got over 1 million, you know, citizens of the Israeli occupation entity who also have Russian citizenship. So ultimately, it's shown that Russia and China are not willing to upset the United States of America when it comes to this. And they're almost waiting for the battle to come to their yard, if you will, in order to stand up and to take this kind of action. So ultimately, no liberation for Palestine will happen except at the hands of the Palestinians. And the Palestinians have proven that they are absolutely steadfast, and they will not give up. And we know that occupations, transgressions, torture, besiegement, they're all tools of savagery that are practiced against the Palestinian nation so it can remain isolated and has nothing. But resistance emerging and solidifying itself is very natural. It's not natural for there to be no resistance based on the extent of the transgression that is occurring. And if we look at the results, I mean, the Oslo Accords happened 3 decades ago, and October the 7th happened 3 decades after it. So occupation will only breed resistance, and even international law itself gives legitimacy to armed resistance as a reaction to occupation. And ultimately, the whole world today is at a completely different place due to this confrontation. The world has woken up.
Right, Ajamo, I want to talk a little bit about the operational mechanics of this ISF ruling model. What mechanisms, with Egypt and Israel controlling the borders, will be there without entrenching external control over Palestinian free movement?
Well, I mean, the control would be total. And I'm more concerned about the so-called training of a force internally within the Gaza Strip by Egypt and the occupation forces. Because that spells a force that would be completely in opposition to the Palestinian people themselves. There's nothing about this plan that makes any real sense, that these folks seem to be operating in an alternative universe. And you know, the very fact that we have to give this some time and some degree of legitimacy, you know, it just sort of compounds the fact that, you know, these forces have the ability to recreate reality, if you will. But in their attempt to do that, they devise processes and policies that undermine their own objectives. They're not going to be able to implement this plan, this so-called peace plan in Gaza. The history of anti-colonial struggles have supported that. So basically what we're going to see now is a continuation of the suffering of the Palestinian people. And we're going to see, I think, a certain kind of destabilization taking place, even in some of those states that have signed on to this fictional process.
Right, and it's very unfortunate, of course, to hear and to witness. Well, Batul, one final question for you. How will the mission ensure compliance with international humanitarian law and avoid actions resembling occupation?
Absolutely, and I echo exactly what the guest has just said. It's absolutely impossible to ascertain that because we've just had 2 years of genocide in which it was perpetrated by America that is putting this supposed peace plan forward. So the one that is orchestrating it ultimately is the one who perpetrated the genocide. It's crazy, right? They come under the guise of peace. So all of a sudden now they're talking about peace, whereas they were the proponents of the genocide, and now they're talking about reconstruction and making something out of Gaza, when these weapons, Israel could not have conducted this genocide for one day without the American support. So it's absolutely impossible. And what do we expect to see? We expect to see further resistance and the Palestinians remaining steadfast.
Right, and one final question for Ajamu. Of course, will there be any independent bodies investigating